Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A program in three acts today. Act one, political money. Act two, the lack of money. Act three, too much money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here for the Marketplace podcast on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 23rd of January today. Last night in Miami, Justin Bieber was arrested for... Oh, no, wait. Sorry, wrong program. Last night, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, yeah, that's better. Jack Lew said he is going to run out of money a little bit earlier than he had been thinking. Lew, of course, has the debt limit firmly in his sights, the date by which Congress will have to raise the amount that Lew can borrow to pay our debts or else. Late February is the new estimate, when the money coming in basically won't cover the money going out. And so not for the first time, it does kind of make one think the government is living paycheck to paycheck. Marketplace's David Gura gets us going.
After we hit the debt limit, the Treasury Department could keep us solvent for a little while longer using what are called extraordinary measures.
The X date is when the extraordinary measures run out.
Steve Bell's a guy who pays close attention to that X date and how much cash the government has on hand. He's with the Bipartisan Policy Center. I asked Bell if the government's robbing Peter to pay Paul, if he thinks we're living paycheck to paycheck.
We really are right now.
Maybe not paycheck to paycheck, but payday loan to payday loan.
Payday loan to payday. That's a very good way of putting it, yes.
Of course, the government's getting a much better interest rate than you'd get at a payday lender. Now, it's hard to say precisely when the government will come up short. On any given day, it doesn't know for sure how much money's coming in and how much money's going out. But Bell says if history is any guide...
This is the worst possible time you could have this happen.
Turns out February is a tough month, budget-wise. Alex Gelber teaches public policy at UC Berkeley.
Treasury is going to have a lot of payments going out relative to receipts coming in.
And that's because in February, a lot of Americans file their taxes, Americans who know they're going to get refunds. Rudy Penner is an economist with the Urban Institute. He says on top of that, the government's going to cut a lot of other checks.
They make a gargantuan number of payments.
Interest payments, Social Security payments. In all, we're talking about 3 to 5 million of them each and every day. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
You know how political reporters have been mumbling about the 2016 presidential race having started already? About this hopeful going to Iowa and this hopeful making a big policy speech? Well, I got news for you, political reporters. That was nothing. The 2016 campaign actually starts now because the money people have gotten publicly involved. Priorities USA Action, the biggest of the liberal super PACs, says it's already started fundraising for Hillary Clinton, official candidacy for the former Secretary of State, or no official candidacy. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has this report on the eternal run for the White House.
It almost sounds shocking, fundraising so far ahead of the election. But really, is it really shocking?
We've had a permanent campaign for many, many years, really decades.
Larry Sabato teaches politics at the University of Virginia, but if fundraising isn't happening any earlier, there is more pressure to get organized earlier. In part, that's because outside groups or ambitious billionaires can throw money into a race at any time. Bob Biersack is a senior fellow at the Center for Responsive Politics.
In a world where one or two people can decide they really want this person to be the next president and they're going to invest tens of millions, and that can come at any time, you can't afford to wait.
Candidates in 2008 spent $1.7 billion on the presidential race. In 2012, they spent just over $2 billion. UVA Sabato says there are a few things that may push 2016 to break a new record.
With every additional cycle, you have new technologies that have to be funded.
So, for example, data mining and voter tracking technology. Plus, it's an open race. There's no incumbent, which means there may be a lot more candidates than last time. Still, there is a limit to how much campaign spending can grow, and Stephen Ansola Beher thinks we're reaching it. He teaches politics at Harvard.
In general, over the long stretch of American history, the amount of money that goes into campaigns tracks with the amount of money in the society.
So the $3 billion presidential race may be a ways off, though I'm not betting any money. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
You could probably blame us for the happenings on Wall Street. We noted the 1,780th day of the bull market on the program yesterday, and look what traders did today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There has been rare bipartisanship in Washington lately, and I'm not talking about the budget. It's both Democrats and Republicans actually agreeing on something. The idea that Americans can be upwardly mobile is a thing of the past. In point of fact, the politicians are wrong. There's a big new study based on tens of millions of anonymous tax records that shows the odds of climbing the income ladder haven't really changed much in the past 20 years. Raj Chetty co-authored the study. He's also an economics professor at Harvard University. Professor Chetty, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I've been trying to figure out whether this paper is good news or bad news. Mobility has not gone down over time, which I guess is good, but geography matters. There are great disparities in this country.
Yes, that's exactly right, Guy. So what we're finding is that mobility, contrary to popular perception, your odds of moving up in the income distribution have not fallen significantly over the past few decades in the U.S. But importantly, the level of mobility throughout the past 30 or 40 years or so in the U.S. has not been very high compared to most other developed countries.
I'm going to crib from David Leonhardt, who wrote the article in the New York Times today about your paper. He points out that the economic penalty of being born poor has grown over time. Who your parents are matters now apparently more than ever.
Yes, that's exactly right. The reason who your parents are matters more than ever, in a sense the birth lottery matters more than ever, is because mobility has stayed the same. So if you're born to a high-income parent versus a low-income parent, that's going to generate a wider difference in your income level as a child today than it did 30 years ago when we had a more equal society.
Which is amazingly disheartening, I mean, to be completely subjective about it.
It is worrisome. You know, the way I look at it is mobility matters more now than it ever did. We should be quite concerned about mobility in a society with a lot of inequality because kids who don't have a chance to move up in the income distribution are really getting left behind in today's economy. And so I think that's why it's more imperative than ever to understand what the determinants of mobility are and what we can do from a policy point of view to improve kids' chances of moving up in the income distribution.
How much of this is the rise of the 1%, though? I mean, the rich, as has been reported, as we know, as you say in this paper, the rich keep getting richer.
Yes, exactly. You're right to highlight the 1%. That's an important part of why inequality has risen so much in the past 30 years in the U.S. And interestingly, what we find is that there isn't that much of a correlation between top 1% income shares and mobility. And so that could potentially explain why we're not seeing that much of a change in mobility over time, because most of the increase in inequality in the U.S. in recent decades has been coming from this extreme upper tail of top 1%ers.
If we know which cities provide the best basis for upward mobility, then why can't we just look at that and say, well, let's do this in a whole bunch of other places? Can't we just bottle that and sell it around and fix these problems that we have?
Yeah, that would be terrific if we knew what that secret—
He says simplistically, yeah.
If we knew sort of what the secret sauce of Salt Lake City or San Jose was, we could just replicate that everywhere else. Unfortunately, it's much more complicated than that because we don't know exactly what that secret sauce is. There's so many things that are different about these different cities. To give you one example, you know, we find a correlation with segregation. Well, why does segregation matter? Maybe in places with more segregation, you also have less funding for schools in low-income areas. And so maybe the ultimate root cause is actually school quality. Disentangling all those different mechanisms is a really complicated challenge for social science, but something we're hoping we'll be able to make progress on in the coming years.
Raj Chetty is a professor of economics at Harvard University. He's the co-author, with a bunch of other people, on a series of new papers about economic mobility in this country. Professor Chetty, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Other than if you like your health plan, you get to keep it, maybe one of the most memorable selling points of the Affordable Care Act was that consumers were going to have options, choices about what kinds of coverage they want. Well, much like if you like your health plan, you get to keep it, the idea of options and choices comes with an asterisk. Alabama is among a dozen or so states where every county has just one, maybe two insurers. Gigi Duban reports that people living in rural towns in Alabama seem to have the least choice and the costliest plans.
Here in Blount County, most people work at either the school board or at a chicken processing plant. On a recent Saturday morning, a handful of locals gather at a church to learn about their health insurance options.
So what's the big deal about the Affordable Health Care Act? The big deal is no longer can you just have an a la carte kind of health care plan.
Chris Mosley, a supervisor with Birmingham Healthcare, tells them that here, as far as insurance companies go, it's slim pickings.
In Blount County, if an individual is going to participate in the Affordable Care Act marketplace, they are going to have to buy a bronze, silver, gold, or platinum plan specifically from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Alabama. The other competitor is not competing in your county, okay?
In Alabama, Blue Cross and Blue Shield pretty much owns the health insurance market. In 64 of Alabama's 67 counties, it's the only insurer through the Federal Health Care Exchange. People in the other three counties also have Humana as an option. But Mosley says,
most people don't know about Humana. It's not a company that people are very familiar with.
Cynthia Cox is a policy analyst with the Kaiser Family Foundation. She says most insurers under the Affordable Care Act are offering multiple plans to choose from. The issue is it's usually just one company offering all the plans.
Enrollees in these areas will still be able to choose between different levels of coverage, but the bigger issue is the lack of competition.
Mike Doonan is executive director of the Massachusetts Health Policy Forum. He says that can have a profound effect on consumers.
So the less competition there is in the marketplace, the less incentive there is for health insurance companies to keep their premiums low.
And Cox says where one insurer dominates, you see higher premiums.
For example, a 40-year-old in an area with just one insurer might pay $20 a month more than if they were living in an area with multiple insurers.
So why are rural areas being hit so hard? Well, because there are fewer people there. But Mike Doonan of the Massachusetts Health Policy Forum says even in states where there's virtually no competition, there's one huge incentive to keep premiums affordable.
They do want to attract people and get them enrolled. And if they do put their premium rates too high, then people are going to opt to pay the penalty.
Especially healthy people, he says. In Blount County, Alabama, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You didn't know I was wealthy because you never came to my house, right?
Well, right. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, it wasn't us. Investors didn't care much for weaker manufacturing data out of China overnight, so the Dow Industrials off 175 points, about 1%, closed at 16,197. The NASDAQ retreated 24 points, more than a half percent, ended things at 4218. The S&P 500 slipped 16 points, about 0.9%. Closed at 1828. Phone maker Nokia rang down 10% after the company said handset sales fell in the fourth quarter. Some phone companies had a better day, though. AT&T was up 1.3%. Verizon veered up 1.1%. Netflix netted a 16.5% gain today. The streaming video provider reported earnings and revenue above forecasts late yesterday. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The annual Oregon Truffle Festival begins in Eugene. The agenda includes a truffle dog training seminar, truffle hunts, and truffle consumption. 10 years ago, NASA's Opportunity rover landed on Mars for a three-month mission. The persistent robot continues to explore the red planet. And comedian John Belushi was born on January 24, 1949. He would have been 65. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The governor of the great state of Michigan, Republican Rick Snyder, announced a new plan to shore up the bankrupt city of Detroit today. It's called immigration. Snyder wants the federal government to set aside 50,000 visas for skilled immigrants, it should be said, on the condition that they live and work in the Motor City and presumably create some jobs. Kate Davidson has the story.
Rick Snyder calls himself one tough nerd. Now he wants to enlist an army of foreign nerds to create jobs in Detroit.
Let's bring 50,000 high-skilled immigrants to Detroit.
So he's asking for 50,000 employment-based visas, EB-2s, over the next 5 years.
Think about the power and the size of this program, what it could do to bring back Detroit even faster and better. It's outstanding.
And it might be hard to get, for starters.
Immigration law is extremely specific.
Doris Meissner should know. She's former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. She says the U.S. grants roughly 40,000 EB-2s a year. They are not geographically based. So corralling 10,000 a year for Detroit alone would be new. And it would raise questions of fairness.
You could imagine putting together a program that is available to financially strapped cities all around the country so that this wouldn't just be for Detroit.
Richard Herman is an immigration lawyer in Cleveland. He's said for years that economics should drive more of immigration policy, steering high-skilled immigrants towards places like
Detroit, Cleveland, Toledo, Youngstown. We're dying out here. I mean, you know, Cleveland used to be 950,000 people. Now we're down to 390,000.
Herman says attracting skilled immigrants is not just good for the tax base. He says immigrants can help the industrial Midwest reclaim its old entrepreneurial spirit. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Vice President Biden got on the phone today with the president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych. The vice president said there would be, quote, consequences for the U.S.-Ukraine relationship if the violence and protests in Kiev continue. David Stern is the BBC correspondent in Ukraine. We got him in Kiev. David, it's good to have you with us.
Hello there.
These protests started months ago with European Union membership, certainly in the very forefront of what was going on. That, I imagine, has faded a bit. It's not about the EU and economic development so much anymore, is it?
Well, it is and it isn't. It is the EU issue is still up there. Obviously, other issues have overtaken that. Most recently, the terrible death of at least two of the protesters. Before that, we just this last week, we saw a package of laws that the parliament passed and the president signed, which cracked down on public protests or limited them. But as I was saying, the EU is still up there.
Can you still go to market and buy dinner supplies? Can people go to work? Those kinds of things.
In Kiev, it has affected business in the center of town. I was walking around today. Many businesses around the central area are closed. The place where the clashes have been taking place is a combat zone. I just came back from there, and there's a ceasefire, but it's a very tense situation with people standing around with metal bars and sticks with helmets on their heads, anticipating that fighting with the police may break out, or in fact, the police may storm.
There are those in Ukraine who want the European Union. There are those who want Russia. Either way, though, if I'm an investor with some capital, none of what's going on there makes me want to spend money in Ukraine.
Well, exactly. Whatever the outcome, it looks like Ukraine may suffer. It's difficult to see how they can extract themselves out of this situation. What Mr. Yanukovych seems to have done with his deal with Russia, where he got $15 billion in prospective loans and also cheaper gas,
right.
is to have fended off a disaster, an economic disaster. And I've been told that it would possibly was just weeks away. They were really just scraping the bottom of the barrel. Now he's managed to buy himself a little bit of breathing room, but he's definitely not bought himself a successful economy. Ukraine is in recession right now. It doesn't look like it's going to get out. And obviously, yes, the turbulence doesn't really make it look like a very attractive place. But let's be honest, if the turbulence wasn't there, it wouldn't be that great an attractive place.
David Stern, the BBC correspondent in Kiev, in Ukraine. David, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
So there was that study that Raj Chetty and I were talking about, economic mobility in this country and, to a degree, inequality as well. It's been a couple of years now since Occupy Wall Street, really, that people in the top slice of this economy have come to be known as the 1%. And generally speaking, the 1% don't advertise the fact that they are more fortunate than the rest of us. Reporter Sean Cole has a phrase for that. He calls them the stealthy wealthy. And he went out and decided to ask some of them why the stealthiness. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, here's Sean.
I knew this wouldn't be the easiest story to do. I mean, what, do you send out a mass email saying I want to talk with rich people on national radio about how they don't like to talk about being rich? Which is what I did. Because it had happened where I'd known someone for a while, discovered he was wealthy, and thought, how did I miss what seems like a pretty fundamental fact about him? And then, 2 days after I sent that email, it happened again.
Here it is. Oh my goodness.
I got a message back that said, Sean, we used to know each other. I might be able to be of some service on your story. My contact info is below, Adam Blank.
Hey. Hello, sir.
Come on in.
Wow. This is...
it's conspicuous. This is
I hadn't seen Adam in almost 20 years. He'd gone to school with a friend of mine.
What do you want to do?
And I had no idea that he'd inherited millions of dollars from his grandfather and his father, nor that he currently lives in a three-story house in Brooklyn with a basement, back deck, backyard, and one very special feature that practically made my eyes moist.
Oh my God, you have a garage.
These days he spends a lot of time managing the wealth, but he had crappy jobs as a kid, just like the rest of us, and then worked in social services and then in the film industry. In most ways, he's about as stealthy as they come.
You didn't know I was wealthy because you never came to my house, right? So why would you think? I don't dress wealthy. If I had wealthy friends, you probably wouldn't know me. My peer set is more like you, right? Writers, designers, right? So I can't go, Sean, what do you think about private equity investing?
So he just doesn't talk about his money over much. And in interviewing him and a couple of other stealthy wealthy folks for the story, I found a few commonalities. One is not knowing the money is coming to you until it does, and being kind of thrown by it. That happened to Adam when he was maybe 21 years old. And it also happened to a guy named Burke Stansberry, who inherited more than $1 million when he was about 19, with more to come.
And I remember the day when my dad sort of sat down and gave me a four-page printout of my investments and my trust fund, and I laughed. I mean, it sort of, more than anything, it struck me as like totally ridiculous that I would have that kind of money.
This is also around the time that Burke started to blossom into the full-fledged political activist he is now, working mainly around issues of economic justice and wealth disparity. And he ultimately came to believe that people were poor in the world because other people were rich.
And because I had just realized that I was a millionaire, I saw myself on the wrong side of that divide. That was the moment where I started to enter into pretty deep depression, basically, because of feelings of shame and guilt around who I was and my background.
And also a feeling of isolation. After all, there aren't a lot of friendly ears available to the problems of the wealthy. But he's a lot more open about his financial situation now, in part because of an organization he joined called Resource Generation. It's been featured on the show before. Mainly, it helps wealthy young people leverage their money toward the causes they care about. But it also hosts these group sessions where members can talk about problems that might be unrelatable to their friends.
I call it my rich kids unpack their sh** group.
This is Rachel Schragis, another member of Resource Generation.
And I say to people, like, you are so glad that I have rich kids unpack their shit group, because otherwise I might want to unpack it on you, and, like, that's not appropriate, because it's actually, even if it's really stressful to be rich, it's really stressful to be poor, right, in ways I don't know.
Rachel sort of came out about her wealth when she became involved in the Occupy movement, thinking she should be transparent about being a 1%er herself. She's in grad school for art right now and deals with the fact of her wealth in her work. There's this one piece where she essentially organizes her thoughts into different colored shapes, sort of like thought balloons.
Like this one. It says, I've heard people joke that the most important tool for an artist to have is a trust fund, and I think it's kind of true. And so I was like, well, that sentiment is both about art and class privilege, so I'm going to do it in this yellowy-green color. And so then when I did that...
But there are still moments when it's just hard to join a basic conversation, she says. Like when people are commiserating, as people do, about not having enough money.
At different points in my life, I would play along in that game. right? And be like, oh, I'm broke. And I was like, oh, when I mean I'm broke, I mean that there's no more in my checkings account and I just have to transfer some more, right? Like, that's not what other people mean. They mean broke. And so sometimes you just have to, like, not talk, right? Like, not say anything.
So yes, the stealthiness can come out of embarrassment of riches, but it also might be because their experience isn't relevant to the conversation. We're all different. I couldn't join a conversation about what it's like not to be insanely handsome. And after all, money's personal. I think a lot of us feel like we have a right to know when someone's extremely wealthy. But if that person doesn't know you very well, why should they talk about it? In New York, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, today you have heard no doubt of Peyton Manning's affinity for the word Omaha as he brings the Denver Broncos to the line of scrimmage. Could be a decoy, could be serious. He is not telling. But come Sunday next in Super Bowl XLVIII, guessing how many times Manning is going to say Omaha could win somebody some serious money. The over-under on the number of Omahas has been set at 27.5 by the online betting firm Boveda.lv, just one in a series of what are called proposition bets that get set up around the big game. You choose over, and Manning says Omaha 28 or more times, you win. Under wins at 27 or less. I will say over 32, just to be a bit more specific. Broncos by a touchdown, by the way. And no, I don't hate Seattle, so don't yell at me. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.